Osiris.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of 8 cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hey, it's Zach here. We're off this week as I travel around the twisty roads of England, but on this Halloween, I wanted to send you a special rebroadcast of an episode that maybe most of you haven't heard yet. It's from our first month of shows, and it is one of my all-time favorite conversations I've had with a musician in my life. Almost exactly a year ago around Halloween, we released my talk with Tony Joe White, the legendary swamp blues singer and hitmaker who wrote songs for Elvis and Tina Turner, and in over a half a century of writing and growling with his spooky, otherworldly, low drawl, he never planned to slow down. But there was a twist. Very soon after he summoned me to the haunted Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel bar with the ghosts of silent film stars and crooners hovering above our clinking glasses, Tony passed away. There was so much more I wanted to ask him, and I kind of wish our brief talk could have lasted forever. As Halloween came out of Celtic and Gaelic traditions, merging pagan bonfire ceremonies with the church's more holy, sober rituals on All Saints' Day centuries ago, I think today is a good time to honor our musical saints, who may have left this earth but still haunt and inspire us with their songs and stories. We definitely didn't plan the original episode to be Halloween-themed or about ghosts or finding the devil in the woods, but that's kind of how it turned out with Tony. He has this element to his music that goes under the ground and dredges up strange things and brings them into the light. In many ways, Tony was more connected to the spirit world than most of us. And on this Halloween, as kids in masks run past me here in Sheffield, England, screaming their heads off, in joy or terror, I can't tell, I can't help but think of a story that Tony told me about his parents finding the devil in the jail out in the woods in Arkansas. Sure, he admitted, maybe it was just backcountry legend or just entertainment with nothing else to do, but they believed it, and he saw it in their eyes, that the dark spirits of our nature were always lurking around us if you just looked hard enough into the dark. So as people walk past me now with blood on their faces and horns sprouting out of their skulls and their teeth sharp and their hooves hoary, I wanted to put on a song to introduce this rebroadcast. It's a song that came out of Tony's spooky story. They caught the devil and they put him in jail in Eudora, Arkansas. So once again, the late great Tony Joe White. Thanks for talking to me, Tony. How are you?
I'm good, man. You?
Hey, I got some iced tea and a hot day. Why not? Did you come to L.A. back in, like, the late 60s, early 70s when you first started writing music?
I played out here a lot.
What were the venues that you used to play back then? Was the Palomino around then?
It was, but I didn't play that. As more like country people playing there. I was doing the Whiskey.
Was the Ashgrove around?
Troubadour.
Troubadour is still around.
Whiskey Go Go. And one other we played mostly, like when you got a new album out, that's where you went and played it for the people.
Still what you do at the Troubadour. It's kind of it's somehow retained its mystique. So you're in town for just a couple days?
Yesterday, today.
Did you come in from south?
I came in from a little town called Leaper's Fork. It's about 40 miles out of Nashville, down by the river. And we left there, man, and storms. Mm. So this felt good.
And you're from Louisiana originally, right?
Yeah.
You moved to Nashville pretty early on, right, in the 60s?
No, I actually moved when I got out of high school. I went straight to Marietta, Georgia. Mm. And my sister lived there. I lived with her and her husband and drove a dump truck for the highway department.
Oh, wow.
For about 3 months or four. And then when it would rain, I wouldn't work, so stay home, play my guitar.
When it was a rainy night over Georgia?
Yeah. So that all came by after I left there, moved on down to Texas, and songs started coming. Poke was one of them. Rain and I was another one. So they were true stories, you know, true happenings.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're one of those people that even someone like me who's been playing roots music in some form for almost 15 years, and I try to feel like I know a lot of the greats and a lot of the people that influenced me and influenced people before me. The way I found out about you was kind of funny. We played in the Netherlands, over in Holland, and we have this very quirky driver, you know, sort of fixer, translator, who, he never says he likes anything. He's like, everything has to be the same. He's like, the Dutch are very fair, right? Even if you play the best show of your life, he's like, well, it was an average.
Pretty good.
Okay show, you know? And we finally asked him, we're like, look, you've been in music for 20 years. If you could see one person right now, who would it be? And he was driving late at night, and he thought about it for like 10 minutes, and he said, Tony Joe White. And we all had to look you up on our phones. We're like, who? You know, this was probably about 5 years ago. And I was like, Tony Joe White? That's the person in the whole world, living or dead, that he would want to see. And of course, you know, Poke Salad Annie and all that stuff came up. And it's one of those things where I've been playing you kind of nonstop ever since, you know. Sometimes it takes a Dutch guy in the middle of the forest driving a van to tell you what your favorite music is, you know.
Yeah, I was just over there about three or four months ago. Amsterdam and all up through there. And there's a place there called, it's a real famous rock club.
Paradiso?
Yeah. We played the big room.
Yeah, man.
And just me and drums, as always, and it was packed to the top, and the
Dutch
people
love this music.
People were really moving to it, you know. So I've been going over there since the late 60s.
But you were embraced in France and in different places way before you were probably bigger here, right?
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know, because the album, Black and White, it had on it, Poke Salad Annie, Raining Out in Georgia, Soul Francisco, which was about the hippie movement.
Yeah.
And so I was playing in Corpus Christi, Texas, and got a phone call from a disc jockey in Paris.
And in French he called you up?
Yeah. And he called me up, and he could speak pretty good English, and I could understand him pretty good. At that time, there wasn't hardly any English going on over there. And he said, the reason I'm calling you is you got the number two record in Paris, France right now. And I said, What's the name of it? I didn't even know. So it went from that to the press and people talking in magazines, and then they called and wanted me to come and play in a tour. And I didn't have even my drums with me then. I was by myself, and I had a wooden Coca-Cola box for my foot, for my drum.
Yeah.
And those places like the whole 1,500, 2,000 people, and they came to dance and move and boogie. And it was just like back down home in Texas. They did. You know, it was like, they didn't need drums or nothing. They just, let's rock.
Do you prefer playing with a stripped-down set? Because a lot of those early records, there's horns and all sorts of studio all over it, but is it...
Yeah, some of the earlier ones, Billy Swan, friend, he loved to use horns, and Muscle Shoals, of course, I love them boys. But I really like to play with just drums on stage.
No bass.
Seems like I've got enough bass going in my thumb.
Are you playing in open tuning?
No, just regular tuning. But it's an old 65 Strat. It's got a good mellow tone. And my drummer's got a great foot. And I've had people to come up and ask us, did we have the bass and the organ taped in the background? And you know who one of them was? In Belgium. He did a show, he opened the show, Solomon Burke.
Wow.
He said, man, I heard organ and drums in that set. I said, this man here, the drummer, is the only other man on the stage.
It's echoing in your brain somewhere.
Yeah, here's it somewhere.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Soul Francisco because, you know, it talks about that the kid's got a little more soul, you know, and I'm curious what you think about, you know, young people making music today.
I think a lot of them are cool. There's some down in a couple of bands down in Mississippi and in Austin that I've heard.
Which bands you like?
Kudzu was one. In Austin, there was just a couple of bands I heard when I was playing down there at the festival. And I really never did get their name, but they were playing good blues stuff, kind of rock and blues with five-piece band, that kind of thing. But they seemed to know what they were doing.
There's definitely conversations I've had with other young artists who are from California, from all over the place, about sort of how roots music, blues, funk, and soul, and all this stuff seems to be definitely rooted in the South, but a lot of the best players that we know are all San Francisco or from Boston or from all over the place. I'm curious what you think, you know, growing up in Louisiana and Georgia and you know, all that stuff, did it seep into your music, your environment?
Well, of course, the Louisiana did. I lived on a cotton farm with my dad and mom and older brother and five sisters.
That's a lot of sisters.
Seven kids. And we had 40 acres on the river by the swamps. And all of them played guitar and piano and sang.
Musical family.
Except I had never tried to play nothing with them or anything. I just sat on the porch and listened to them in the evening. You
were
know.
The youngest?
Yeah.
This was in Goodwill, Louisiana. Where is that?
It's up in the northeast end, not too far from Greenville, Mississippi, and up on that corner there. And the food's different, the music's different. I mean, most of them are really like blues and hanging like that.
The line that you wrote, you know, on when you live off the land, you don't have time to think about another man's color. And, you know, they lived in a shack just like our shack type thing, you know. Do you think things have gotten better from those times, you know, in terms of how the races are intermingling with each other and working things out?
It moved along. Those were sweet, syrupy little lazy days, you know, back in then. And Willie and Laura Mae Jones, which is the song you're talking about, it's got them words. They actually lived about 5 miles down the dirt road from us. And they would come down and pick cotton with us, sit on the porch and play. And it was just like home to me. And then my brother, I was about 14, he brought home an album by Lionel Hopkins. Mm. And up to then, I just heard gospel and country music. And he put that on the old record player. And I heard my first blues.
And then How old were you?
I was 14. Mm. So I started sneaking my dad's guitar up to my room at night and playing that record. And as it turned out, later I got to meet all my heroes eventually. I actually played on an album after Poke Satellite was out, and Warner Brothers called me and said, come to L.A., Lightning Hopkins is recording a new album.
In L.A.?
Yeah, and it's called the L.A. Mudslide. And I came and brought a guitar and my harmonica. He come walking in with his wife.
How old was he, you think?
Me?
No, how old was Lightning Hopkins?
He looked like he was around mid-50s, late-50s by then. I think I was around 23, 24.
Were you starstruck?
Almost, but my fingers moved good. And he said, he stopped. His wife had a paper sack with a big jug of wine in it. He took that wine out, went into the studio, and he come where I was sitting with my guitar and harmonica. He said, you gonna play with me, boy? And I said, that's right. He said, hit me something. And I did a little Baby Please Don't Go, one of his tunes or something on the guitar. And he said, turn it on. The engineer, they turned the tape on and he played 14, 13 songs in a row between sips of wine. And I just went along with him best I could, because Lightning plays in town, out of time, and Lightning time, you know.
Was he playing an open tuning?
He was playing an open tuning.
G tuning or something, yeah.
And we got through with him. It didn't take 45 minutes.
Each song's about 2 minutes long?
Yeah. And he was making some of them up as he went.
Yeah.
So he got up and he shook my hand. He said, real nice playing with you, man. He quit calling me boy.
Yeah.
And he went in the studio, and there's a guy in a suit in there, and he took that paper sack and held it out. The guy dropped 10 $100 bills in that sack. Lightning said, it's been nice, y'all, thank you.
Where was he from?
Houston, Texas. And they got on a bus, him and his wife, took that sack of money and left. No contracts. Nothing.
Took the bus?
Trailways. A Greyhound.
Well, it's like those old timers, like, I mean, Aretha Franklin, she just passed, you know, she only got paid in cash in her handbag and it would be on the piano. That's the only, isn't Chuck Berry also takes a briefcase of cash? Like,
Chuck was real bad about it. Wilson Pickett was bad about it, wanting the money right then. As soon as I get through playing, or before I play even.
Sometimes when people, you know, festivals or whatever, pay you before you play, it almost feels like bad luck.
Yeah,
I haven't even got up there yet.
I know. I never have liked to do that. The only time that was ever offered to me, I turned it down. I was playing with Sly and the Family Stone, and we were playing in Boston at the college, and Sly was late as usual, and it was me and a drummer. The promoter came back after Sly was about nearly an hour late, and he said, Tonzo, I'm going to go ahead and pay you now. He said, why don't y'all just go ahead and head to your room? I don't think Sly's going to show up, and that crowd is not in a good mood right now.
Yeah.
He said, especially seeing him, white faces come walking out and play. I said, well, look, man, we come all this way, two flights to get up here. I'd like to play one or two songs at least. And my drummer, Sammy Creason, he was from Arkansas, he said, get the money and let's get out of here, man, get it.
Yeah.
And I'd had a couple of Budweiser beers and I was feeling loose and I said, oh, I want to play one song. And we walked out on stage, and I had that guitar all ready to go. And somebody in the audience started hollering, a couple of women or something. Said, "You better be good after taking all this time." And I was like, "Well, it ain't me taking the time." And anyway, I hit into boom, boom, boom. That guitar thing on the front. And man, they let it go. And I ended up playing 45 minutes for the crowd. And Sly finally came.
You have a recording of Boom Boom that you put out recently.
Yeah.
Did you ever get to play with John Lee Hooker?
Played with him in Nashville at a concert he did. And he liked Polk's Out of Atlanta, so he had invited me in. And like Light, and he liked Polk. So they'd all eaten it, knew what it was about, knew it was real.
How did you find out that Elvis was going to cover that song, Polk Salad Annie?
Well, Polk had made it to like number two in America in the chart, and then Rainy Night pops up and right in behind it with Brooke Benton. So I had fireworks coming every which way, and Felton Jarvis, who was Elvis's producer, he called me and said, he said, "Tony Joe, we're gonna send a plane down to Memphis, pick you and your wife up, bring you to Las Vegas, and let you watch us do Polk Salad Annie each night. We're gonna record it 6 nights."
Wow.
I said, "Who's we, Felton?" He said, "Well, you know I'm doing Elvis." And I said, "And that's who's gonna do it?" He said, "Yeah." So here was another person I'd looked up to, and all of a sudden he's cutting my song, you know. We flew out there and stayed.
Did you talk to him at all?
6 weeks, yeah. Talked to him every night. Back in the dressing room, he had an acoustic guitar back there, and he had sent word to Felton to tell me to come back after the show each night. And he wanted to learn some blues licks. And I just showed him 2 or 3 licks, you know, something he could mess around with. And the next night he'd come in, I'd say, "Hey, how's the guitar licks coming?" He said, "Man, I forgot them all. Could you run them by me one more time?" Anyway, it was like that 6 nights in a row. He never did get it.
I don't know how Elvis played his guitar too straight if he's moving around so much like that. Yeah.
Well, I told him, I said, "Man, you don't really need to learn to play guitar." I said, "Just hold it in your hands if you want a guitar. Don't worry about playing. You don't have to play the way you sing and move." So he always was cool to me and treated me good. And then down in Memphis later on at Stax, he recorded a couple more of my songs. Really down home.
Do you have a certain amount of dates that you play every year on the road?
No.
Just as it comes?
I pay a lot of attention to writing when a song comes up.
You just write at home in Nashville?
There, I write down by the river mostly. I got a little studio in the barn out there too. But I've just always didn't like to stay out too long, because for some reason when I'm on the road playing gigs, I rarely write a word.
Mm.
But then when I get home and sit down and think about a certain night or certain person, the way they looked or something, something comes in. But so I don't really stay out and just hammer it down.
I'm curious what your favorite food is on the road, depending where you go.
It kind of depends on where I'm at. Like when I leave where I live, if I'm not close to New Orleans or Austin or Baton Rouge, somewhere like that, I just kind of, when I go to Europe or Australia, I pretty well stay with just meat and potatoes and fish sometimes. But when I'm in places like close to New Orleans, get after those crawfish and...
What you grew up with?
That's it.
There's on your Hoodoo album, you have like extra tracks where you're talking about the songs, which is kind of interesting. And you talked about writing a few songs with your wife, and that they had a bit of a mystical bent to them.
Yeah, she's a good writer, and she's like me. She don't just probably write 4 or 5 times a year, you know, but all of a sudden she'll come walking in where I'm playing a guitar in a room or something and go, how does this line sound right here? And she had Undercover Agent almost finished word-wise by Tina Turner. I listened to it. It sounds really good. And I put a few more lines in and the guitar, the chord. Next thing we know, Tina's got it and recorded it.
How did she connect with you?
Her manager was Roger Davies, Australian man. Really good guy. And they were here in L.A. and she was doing a Chrysler commercial. And he said later that he had got a hold of the little reel-to-reel tape. I had 4 songs on it.
And demos you did on reel-to-reel?
Yeah. It was just me and a guitar and my foot. And I had put them 4 songs down. One was Undercover Agent, Steamy Windows, Who Knows, You Know What, and then Foreign Affair, which was, in my mind, that was going to be the song I would show him when I went out. So I brought those 4 songs, and Roger, I went over to the studio where they were recording the commercial. He said, Tina wants to do Undercover Agent. He says, she wants you to play guitar, harmonica, she wants to cut it back porch like you cut it. Just organ, bass, drums, you and her. I said, cool. And here we went, and she wanted to go to Chicago and record it.
Why Chicago? Is it Chess Records? Was she on Chess Records now?
I don't know who it was with. I can't think she was with Capitol at that time. So anyway, we recorded that in one take, and she come out of the booth, singing booth, and she said, hey, I heard something else on that little tape you got. She said, I really like it. I'd like to cut it. Steamy Windows. So here we go into Steamy Windows, and again, one take, because she's got it all down. She don't mess around.
She had memorized it already?
She had it.
Wow.
Had it in her hotel room that night, in a little tape player. So we ended up cutting one more Chicago, and then she said, there's one more on there, and I'm just living in like a dream, man.
Yeah.
It's like Elvis again, you know, Lionel Hopkins. Here's Tina Turner, done 3 songs, and wants to fly to Paris to do the 4th one.
Why Paris?
She said, it just has the mood, Foreign Affairs. So we go to London.
Did she have her own plane?
Yeah. I cut the tracks there. Mark Knopfler come in. He hung out. Actually played a couple of guitar licks on the song. We all flew to Paris. And Tina went in and nailed it. So she ended up doing all 4. So back to what started, it was Leanne's Undercover Agent for the Blues.
Where did that come from, you think?
She wrote it about Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, the Blues Brothers.
Uh-huh.
They came to Memphis when we was living there. And Duck Dunn was a good friend of mine.
Donald Duck.
And he fished with me. We fished together a lot. And he had invited the whole bunch out to my house for a fish fry. Everybody but Belushi didn't come. Zach Rod, Paul, all of them. So that's how all that kicked off. It was about the Blues Brothers.
That's fun. And I want to do a couple creative questions about your songwriting. What comes first, words or chords?
They switch around. Sometimes guitar chords or licks will come. Sometimes a title will come first. So I don't never really question it or have a set program on how to do it. It's like, I believe it's all sent to me anyway from another spot. And
does it feel like you're channeling from some other plane or some sort of mystical source of creativity?
No, I figure it's all sent down by God and by whoever who influenced me through the years, like most of the people I've been talking about for the last few minutes. I just know that all of a sudden it pops up, and if it's a lick or a title, I build a little campfire and get a six-pack of cold beer, sit down with a guitar by the river there, and just kind of listen to the mind a little bit.
Do you write it down in a notebook or just memorize it?
Not at that time. I just try to let everything be quiet. And then when it gets on down in there that I know it's going to be a song, I write it down.
I want to ask you quickly about the they caught the devil and put him in jail in Eudora, Arkansas. If the devil walked into this restaurant right now, what do you think he would look like?
What I think he would look like?
Or say, who knows?
I would say he would almost look pretty normal, keep everything pretty cool, you know? Because I've got a song now. Well, I've got about 15 new songs over the winter that I haven't put out yet. And one of them it's entitled Raining in the Graveyard. Mm. And it was so natural. The guy was raining in the graveyard. That's where my woman lay. And beside her was her lover in an unmarked grave. So it was just natural that all of a sudden, and the devil walked around keeping his eyes on both the graves. Mm. And he would soon take the lovers and be on his way. And I pictured him right then, and he was kind of a man with a slouch hat and a long overcoat, no tail or nothing like that. But he pops up in certain situations, the word, because in them days and time, the devil in Eudora, Arkansas, my mother and dad, you know, 50 years old, they went in a team of mules and wagons, and everybody from around that country went to Eudora to see the devil. That some hunters had got him in a net.
To go see him, the devil?
And they had him in a jail, in the cell. Because it's the Eudora, Arkansas, the jailhouse in Eudora, Arkansas. Caught the devil and put him in jail. And they were packing ice around the cell, blocks of ice, to keep him from taking his tail and cutting the bars.
And there were sparks coming from his tail?
Sparks coming. So grown people went to see that. And of course, by then, he'd done cut his way out. He was gone. But for a little kid, 8 years old and stuff, to hear that, it was hard to go to sleep that night.
Do you think your parents believed it?
Well, they did not believe it because they went to look. And a lot of other farmers around there, because there was no TV, no nothing like that. So stories was important. A man come running up on a horse going, they caught the devil and got him a big net and got him in a jail.
You think they charged admission to see it?
No, I don't think he missed for that.
Do you believe in ghosts?
Yeah, I do.
There's probably some ghosts in this hotel. This hotel is pretty old.
I would say in this old hotel that have to be, man. It's been here so long. But it's not that I've seen them, but I do believe in them.
I'm curious also about the idea of hoodoo. What does that word mean to you?
Well, hoodoo is like, it's a form of, it's kind of a magical thing. Like a girl hoodooed you, or boy, she put the hoodoo on me. I mean, just looking at her, it knocked you off your feet. And
it's an energy.
And voodoo is the other one, which is taking somebody's hair and burying it in a swamp somewhere, out of a comb, and saying some words over it. That's no good. hoodoo is kind of got a little goodness to it.
All right, so it's like the positive voodoo.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to do a creative exercise where the first thing that comes to your brain when I say a word, don't even think about it. I say vampire.
Blood.
The cross.
Jesus.
Mountaintop.
I would think of Taos, New Mexico from that. I lived there for a while.
You lived in Taos? What was that like?
We had a house out there. It's another way of life, you know. We lived right on the Indian reservation. Our house was backed up to the Pueblos. And I'm half Cherokee, so we had a lot of friends out there that I could go out and hang with them and talk.
From your mom's side or your dad's side?
Mom's. And so I would say mountaintop, Taos.
Broken.
String guitar. Bad.
True love.
Once in a lifetime.
Do you think monogamy and like having one person that you love your whole life is ridiculous, or do you think it's actually the right way to do it?
I can't say about the monogamy, but I can say that it's good for to find someone that you can go a lifetime with and share and hang and have a lot in common together, which my wife and I, we've been married 50-something years. She's a Texas woman.
How'd you guys meet?
She came to a club in Kingsville, Texas. She was going to college at A&I. And she loved music, and she'd heard that there was someone playing at this club. He's a white boy, but he sounded like Elvis and John Lee Hooker. And she loved blues and that kind of thing. She came down and hit it off.
She's been listening ever since.
Yeah.
It takes a certain type of good sport, I think, to be the wife of a lifetime musician.
I couldn't think about it if I was a girl. All that you're exposed to and all you have to really watch out for on the road.
You're a pretty rare case in many forms, but, you know, the fact that you've been with your wife and you're playing this long and you know, you guys are doing great, I mean, that's hard to do.
It's having the music in common and writing together sometimes. I think that was a big string, stout rope like in our lives all the way down.
What if you weren't playing music, what do you think you would be doing?
I probably wouldn't be breathing on the earth. But if I, you know, would just, I'd be fishing. I'd be one of the best fishermen on earth.
There's a certain, I think, trance-like sound and feeling to some of your music, which also reminds me of, you know, stuff like Lightning Hopkins and John Lee Hooker, where it has this sort of timeless flow to it, like a river, where you don't know when you're going to the four chord necessarily, you know, or you don't know if you're ever going to go to the five chord. Yeah. Do you feel like sometimes when you're playing with other people, it takes a little bit to have them get into that flow, but it's pretty unique?
Well, that's why I like live concerts. Just my drummer, and he don't have to know the key.
Yeah.
So I just can hit it in total freedom, jump into any song I want, go all the way back to the first album, all the way up to now. And it's just, I like bass and organ, but I like them in certain spots, but not to have it every night. But this new album that we just did, it's blues. And I wanted to do a whole blues album for a long time, because I was raised on it.
What do you consider blues versus
the stuff you're doing normally? Like 12-bar style?
Well,
or?
What I do normally is what I... It's called swamp rock, you know?
Swamp rock, yeah.
It's blues you can dance to.
Okay.
It's got a groove and a beat. But we moved, we had the studio in Franklin, Tennessee, a real big old house. And all these years we've been cutting it there with Jody, my son, and he's bass and me, guitar and drums. And for this album, I told Jody, I said, if we're gonna do a blues album, you gotta make it really sound like it. So we moved the whole studio out to my house and the barn, and we got a couple of carpenters come in there and do some work on the inside of two stalls. And I said, now we'll cut some blues out here. It's got a tin roof. So a lot of the songs is just me and a guitar, harmonica in my foot. And then I brought in Fleetwood, who's the drummer. He come in and play brushes on Boom Boom Boom. And we put a little bass with that. So all the interviews that I'm doing across the world, Europe and Australia, everybody keeps asking, how did you get it to sound so authentic and like almost like 1930?
Mm.
And I said, we cut it in a barn.
Yeah.
And got back with the coyotes howling and the rain would hit the roof and we didn't care, we let it go.
Jody produces a lot of your records?
Yeah. He's done about the last 7 or 8 albums. And always, since he got out of college, he been in the publishing, booking, and stuff like that.
That must be nice working with your son.
It really is, man. And he's got a great feel, got a great ear, you know, for what's happening with everything. But he really got in to this album because he had never, believe it or not, really sat down and listened to Hooker or Lightning or none of them. And he got into them and he can't quit now.
It's a family business.
He found a song by Charlie Patton, you know, the originator of blues, they'd say, yeah. Latin said he was.
Right.
Called Ain't Going Down a Dirt Road by Myself. Jody found that and played it for me. I said, oh man, yeah, we got to do that. Turn tape on.
Are you actually recording on tape?
Reel to reel. So 16 track.
You think it still sounds better?
Still sounds better, especially in this case with acoustic guitar and harmonica and your
foot. There's that little like natural echo in tape for some reason that just feels better for me.
It's there.
It's like the only time I really, really like the sound of my voice. We did our album on 2-inch tape like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have like a big sound, but it has like this spooky vibe that's hard to capture, you know?
It's really cool and funny about all the rappers in the last few years have bought up just about all the 16-track tapes. Because they like to do the voice and words fur on it. Put some kind of groove with it on drum. But they said ain't no other machine can capture that thing. Said it's a little mystery in it.
Do you listen to hip-hop at all?
Yeah, I like hip-hop. Yeah.
Like who?
I can't really name many people that I've checked out, but I've got one or two on this new one. Not this new album, but the one that's still in the barn. Got a hip-hop groove.
If you could put a music festival together on the outside your barn, anyone living or dead, who would it be? Who would play with you?
Well, that'd be hard to do, man, because I would go back.
Yeah, living or dead.
I would go back to Lightning, Elvis, John Lee. Most of them are went to the other side by now, but there's still, you know, people I like. I still dig Bob Dylan a lot, although I liked some of the earlier stuff best, but he was original to me. That's a hard question. It'd take a long time to dig them all up.
I'm always, it makes me laugh when I see Bob Dylan on another huge tour. It's like, why is he touring so much still? I think it's just like, that's his life, right? Do you think the road and like traveling and having to perform to people, does it become like almost an addiction, an obsession?
There's probably something to that. It's like him and Willie Nelson, all that is their life. Willie said the only time he sleeps is when he's on that bus. Mm. And I can't even ride a bus, man. A bus makes me seasick. So everybody's got different things. I don't know how Bob stays out there all this time, man. I played with him in Australia.
He doesn't need to do it.
Year before last, I played a big festival in Australia, the Byron Bay Blues Festival. Mm. And,
he was there? Does he know about your music?
Yeah. He came when I was doing about the fourth, fifth album at the Bitter End in New York, playing it, you know, for the press and everybody. He came to the show that night. And about two-thirds of the way through the show, a waitress brought a little piece of paper up, laid it by my foot, and it said, "Please do the High Sheriff of Calhoun Parish." And it just said BD on it. Hmm.
Bob Dylan sending you song requests from the audience?
He sent me a request, man. And also it said, "Meet me next door when you break." Next door was another little bar.
This is what, mid-70s?
Yeah, pretty well. Pretty close to 80. Hmm. So when we knocked off, did our show, I walked over to that little bar and it was a place with peanuts, shells on the floor and cold beer and all that. And I kept looking around for him because I kept expecting to see this kind of an older dude, you know, and at least not a little kid, you know. And I finally spotted a guy in the very back in a corner, and he had on a little snow cap or something other like that, and his face was real clean shaven. He looked like he's 16 years old.
Oh, even in 1980, yeah.
And I walked closer to him. I said, "Bob?" He said, "Tony Joe, sit down." And we sat, had a couple of beers, and just talked for a good while, mostly about songs. But the High Sheriff is the one he liked.
This is why, you know, us Jewish songwriters, we can't shave the beard. Because then we just look like we're 13 years old, like having our bar mitzvahs.
I know my mom, she always, when I'd come home, if I had gotten a haircut, she said, "Oh, that looks good. Makes you look so young. But if you get it long," she said, "boy, you need a haircut. That's really getting on out." That's good. You know, me and Creedence toured for a good while.
Really?
After I had the records out. We toured Europe and over in America.
When was this?
It was in early 70s, mid 70s. Doug Don was playing bass with me at that time. And every night, Creedence or us, we opened the show. We would try to burn each other down, you know, because me and Duck, we fished together, and he knows the swamps. And Fogarty kept talking about over the microphone and how they love to play that swamp music and everything. And I said, "Duck, are any swamps or alligators in Berkeley?" And he said, "No, I don't think so."
Yeah.
So it was a war of who could get the loudest and play the hardest, you know. It was fun, though.
So the last thing I want to ask you is about the progression you think of how you were writing songs and singing, you know, when you started versus today? Or do you feel like it's been this flow that's stayed the same?
It's pretty well stayed the same. Of course, times change and your ideals and stuff, but the guitar licks, they'll move around different ways, different talent, but I still build a fire outside over a campfire, get acoustic guitar and sit down when I get something going. So it's still going.
It's hard to build a campfire on the road and write songs.
Can't.
Unless you go camping, maybe.
Unless you get out of your hotel.
You don't want to light a fire in California right now. You might burn some forest.
Don't
down.
Even think about it. Don't even think the word.
Well, I really appreciate you you talking to me. This has been really fun.
Well, I enjoyed it, man. It's a good question. A lot of different.
Hey, so due to time and sound constraints, Tony couldn't play a song for us on his signature Stratocaster, but here is the title track from his newest album, Bad Mouthin'. It actually just came out a few weeks ago. He was working hard to the end. I think this really captures Tony at his raw best. Here it is, Bad Mouthin'.
Shape up, you better get started. One of these days I'm gonna leave you broken hearted. Bad mouthing. You just keep on bad mouthing. You keep bad mouthing, baby, so I'm gonna put you down. We'll be right back.
there you have it, the one and only Tony Joe White. There goes a bad, bad man. I keep thinking, you gotta go see your heroes before they go, because you never know. I was lucky enough to see Tom Petty for the first time 2 days before he died last year. Man, am I glad I did. These guys are one of a kind. I'd love to give a big thanks to Carrie Baker and Tony's son, Jody White, for helping me set up this interview in the first place. It was a blast. I'll never forget it. If you want to learn more about Tony Joe White, go to thebluegrasssituation.com. In August, we put out a song premiere of his cover of Big Boss Man, written by Jimmy Reed. It's off his newest album, Bad Mouthin', and it sounds awesome. The show on the road is hosted by me, Zach Lupitan, and produced by the handsome Hawaiian, Chris Jacobs, with support from the Bluegrass Situation team. If you love the show on the road, please leave us a review or rating over at itunes.com/showontheroad. Tell your friends, and also be sure to check out BGS's ever-growing collection of podcasts up right now on thebluegrasssituation.com. The show on the road is a part of the BGS Podcast Network. This is Zach Lupitan. See you on the trail.
Hey everyone, this is Tuck from Fit for a King, an off-road minivan. Every week I bring you fun interviews alongside your favorite metalcore entertainers with my new podcast, Get Tucked. Join me every Monday with bands like Counterparts, Crystal Lake, like Moths to Flames, and many more. We play unsigned and undiscovered bands, deep dive into each artist's history, and of course provide the greatest breakdowns in current metalcore. Tune in to Get Tucked every Monday, out now through Sound Talent Media.